important for you to remember, you're not alone. The days when you were are over for you, Rosie. Will you remember that?
Yes.
Are you sure? Yes. And if he does show up, what will you do?
Slam the door in his face and lock it.
And then?
Call 911.
With no hesitation.
None at all, she said, and that was the truth. But she would be afraid. Why? Because Norman was a cop, and they would be cops, the people she called. Because she knew Norman had a way of getting his way. He was an alpha dog.
Because of what Norman had told her again and again and again, that all cops were brothers. And after you called 911, what would you do then?
I'd call you.
Anna nodded. You're going to be fine. Absolutely fine.
I know.
She spoke with confidence. But part of her still wondered, would always wonder, she supposed, unless he showed up and took the matter out of the realm of speculation. If that happened, would all of this life she had lived over the last month and a half, DNS, the Whitestone Hotel, Anna, her new friends, fade like a dream on waking the moment she opened her door to an evening knock and found Norman standing there? Was that possible? Rosie's eyes shifted to her picture, leaning against the wall beside the door to the office, and knew it was not. The picture was facing inward, so only the backing showed, but she found she could see it anyway. Already the image of the woman on the hill with the thundery sky above and the half-buried temple below was crystal clear in her mind, not the least dreamlike. She didn't think anything could turn her picture into a dream. And with luck, these questions of mine will never have to be answered, she thought, and smiled a little. What about the rent, Anna? How much?
$320 a month. Will you be all right for at least 2 months?
Yes.
Anna knew that, of course. If Rosie hadn't had enough runway to assure her of a safe takeoff, they would not have been having this discussion.
That seems very reasonable. As far as the room rent goes, I'll be fine to start with.
To start with, Anna repeated. She steepled her fingers under her chin and directed a keen look across the cluttered desk at Rosie. Which brings me to the subject of your new job. It sounds absolutely wonderful, and yet, at the same time, it sounds iffy, impermanent. These were words which had occurred to her on her walk home. Along with the fact that despite Robbie Leffert's enthusiasm, she didn't really know if she could do this job yet, and wouldn't, not for sure, until next Monday morning. Anna nodded. They aren't the words I would have chosen myself. I don't know what words would be exactly, but they'll do. The point is, if you leave the Whitestone, I can't absolutely guarantee I could get you back in, especially on short notice. There are always new girls here at DNS, as you know very well, and they have to be my first priority.
Of course, I understand that.
I'll do what I could, naturally, but
if the job Mr. Lefferts offered me doesn't pan out, I'll look for work waitressing, Rosie said quietly. My back is much better now, and I think I could do it. Thanks to Dawn, I can probably get a late-shift job in a 7-Eleven or a Piggly Wiggly if it comes to that.
Dawn was Dawn Vereker, who gave rudimentary clerking lessons on a cash register that was kept in one of the back rooms. Rosie had been an attentive student. Anna was still looking at Rosie keenly. But you don't think it will come to that, do you?
No.
She directed another glance down at her picture.
I think it will work out. In the meantime, I owe you so much.
You know what to do about that, don't you?
Pass it on.
Anna nodded. That's right. If you should see a version of yourself walking down the street someday, a woman who looks lost and afraid of her own shadow, just pass it on.
Can I ask you something, Anna?
Anything at all.
You said your parents founded Daughters and Sisters. Why? And why do you carry it on? Or pass it on, if you like that better.
Anna opened one of her desk drawers, rummaged, and brought out a thick paperback book. She tossed it across the desk to Rosie, who picked it up, stared at it,
and experienced a moment of recall so vivid it was like one of the flashbacks combat veterans sometimes suffered. In that instant, she did not just remember the wetness on the insides of her thighs, a sensation like small, sinister kisses, but seemed to re-experience it. She could see Norman's shadow as he stood in the kitchen, talking on the phone. She could see his shadow fingers pulling restlessly at a shadow cord. She could hear him telling the person on the other end that of course it was an emergency. His wife was pregnant. And then she saw him come back into the room and start picking up the pieces of the paperback he had torn out of her hands before beginning to hit her. The same redhead was on the cover of the book Anna had tossed her. This time she was dressed in a ball gown and caught up in the arms of a handsome gypsy who had flashing eyes and apparently a pair of rolled-up socks in the front of his breeches. "This is the trouble," Norman had said. "How many times have I told you how I feel about crap like this?" "Rose?" It was Anna, sounding concerned. She also sounded very far away, like the voices you sometimes heard in dreams. "Rose, are you all right?" She looked up from the book, Misery's Lover, the title proclaimed in that same red foil, and below it, Paul Sheldon's most torrid novel, and forced a smile. "Yes, I'm fine. This looks hot." "Bodice rippers are one of my secret vices," Anna said. "Better than chocolate, because they don't make you fat, and the men in them are better than real men, because they don't call you at 4 in the morning, drunk and whining for a second chance. But they're trash, and do you know why?" Rosie shook her head. "Because the whole round world is explained in them. There are reasons for everything. They may be as far-fetched as the stories in the supermarket tabloids, and they may run counter to everything a halfway intelligent person understands about how people behave in real life. But they're there, by God." In a book like Misery's Lover, Anna Stevenson would undoubtedly run daughters and sisters because she had been an abused woman herself, or because her mother had been. But I was never abused, and so far as I know, my mother never was either. I was often ignored by my husband. We've been divorced for 20 years, in case Pam or Gert hasn't told you, but never abused. In life, Rosie, people sometimes do things, both bad and good, just because. Do you believe that? Rosie nodded her head slowly. She was thinking of all the times Norman had hit her, hurt her, made her cry. And then one night, for no reason at all, he might bring her a half a dozen roses and take her out to dinner. If she asked him why, what the occasion was, he usually just shrugged and said he felt like treating her. Just because, in other words. "Mommy, why do I have to go to bed at 8, even in the summertime, when the sky is still light outside? Just because." "Daddy, why did Grandpa have to die?" "Just because." Norman undoubtedly thought these occasional treats and whirlwind dates made up for a lot, that they must offset what he probably thought of as his bad temper. He would never know, and never understand, even if she told him, that they terrified her even more than his anger and his bouts of rage. Those, at least, she knew how to deal with. "I hate the idea that everything we do gets done because of the things people have done to us," Anna said moodily. "It takes everything out of our hands. It doesn't account in the least for the occasional saints and devils we glimpse among us. And most important of all, it doesn't ring true to my heart. It's good in books like Paul Sheldon's, though. It's comforting. Lets you believe, at least for a little while, that God is sane and nothing bad will happen to the people that you like in the story. May I have my book back? I'm going to finish it tonight, with lots of hot tea. Gallons." Rosie smiled, and Anna smiled back. "You'll come for the picnic, won't you, Rosie? It's going to be at Ettinger's Pier. We'll need all the help we can get. We always do." "Oh, you bet," Rosie said. "Unless Mr. Lefferts decides I'm a prodigy and wants me to work on Saturdays, that is."
"I doubt that."
Anna got up and came around the desk. Rosie also stood. And now that their talk was almost over, the most elementary question of all occurred to her. "When can I move in, Anna?"
"Tomorrow, if you want."
Anna bent and picked up the picture. She looked thoughtfully at the words charcoaled on the backing, then turned it around.
You said it was odd, Rosie said. Why?
Anna tapped the glass fronting with one nail. Because the woman is at the center, and yet her back is turned. That seems an extremely peculiar approach to this sort of painting, which has been otherwise quite conventionally executed. Now she glanced over at Rosie, and when she went on, her tone was a bit apologetic. The building at the bottom of the hill is out of perspective, by the way.
Yes, the man who sold me the picture mentioned that. Mr. Leffert said it was probably done on purpose, or some of the elements would be lost.
I suppose that's true. She looked at it for several moments longer. It does have something, doesn't it? A fraught quality.
I don't understand what you mean.
Anna laughed. Neither do I, except there's something about it that makes me think of my romance novels. Strong men, lusty women, gushing hormones. Fraught, that's the only word I can think of that comes close to describing what I mean. A calm before the storm thing. Probably it's just the sky. She turned the frame around again and restudied the words charcoaled on the backing. Is this what caught your eye to start with? Your own name?
Nope, Rosie said. By the time I saw Rose Matter on the back, I already knew I wanted the painting.
She smiled.
It was just a coincidence, I guess.
The kind that isn't allowed in the romance novels you like. I see. But Anna didn't look as if she did, quite. She ran the ball of her thumb across the printed letters. They smudged easily.
Yes, Rose said. Suddenly, for no reason at all, she felt very uneasy. It was as if somewhere off in that other time zone where evening had already begun, a man was thinking of her. After all, Rose is a fairly common name, not like Evangeline or Petronella.
I suppose you're right, Anna handed the picture over to her. But it's funny about the charcoal it's written in, just the same.
Funny? How?
Charcoal smudges so easily. If it isn't protected, and the words on the backing of your picture haven't been, it turns into nothing but a smear in no time. The words Rose Matter must have been printed on the backing recently. But why? The picture itself doesn't look recent. It must be at least 40 years old, and it might be 80 or 100. There's something else odd about it, too.
What?
No artist's signature, Anna said.
The Manta Ray.
Norman left his hometown on Sunday, the day before Rosie was scheduled to start her new job, the job she was still not entirely sure she could do. He left on the 1105 Continental Express bus. This wasn't a matter of economy, it was a matter, a vital matter, of slipping back inside Rose's head. Norman was still not able to admit how badly her totally unexpected flight had rocked him. He tried to tell himself he was upset because of the bank card, only that and nothing more. But his heart knew better. It was about how he'd never had a clue, not so much as a premonition. There had been a long time in their marriage when he had known her every waking thought and most of her dreams. The fact that that had changed was driving him nuts. His biggest fear, unacknowledged but not entirely hidden from the deeper run of his thoughts, was that she had been planning her escape for weeks, months, possibly even a year. If he had known the truth of how and why she had left, if he had known about the single drop of blood, in other words, he would perhaps have been comforted, or perhaps he would have been more unsettled than ever. Regardless, he realized that his first impulse, to take off his husband's hat and put on his detective's hat, had been a bad idea. In the wake of Oliver Robbins's phone call, he had realized that he needed to take off both of his hats and put on one of hers. He would have to think like her, and riding the bus she had ridden was a way of starting to do that. He climbed up the bus steps with his overnight bag in his hand and stood by the driver's seat, looking down the aisle. "You want to move it, buddy?" a man asked from behind him. You want to find out how getting your nose broken feels? Norman replied without missing a beat. The guy behind him didn't have anything to say to that. He took a moment or two longer deciding which seat he wanted, and then made his way down the aisle to it. She wouldn't have gone all the way to the back of the bus. His fastidious Rose would never have taken a seat near the toilet cubicle unless all the other seats were full, and Norman's good friend Oliver Robbins, from whom he had bought his ticket just as she had assured him that the 1105 was hardly ever full, nor would she want to sit over the wheels, too bumpy, or too close to the front, too conspicuous. Nope. Just about halfway down would suit her, and on the left side of the bus, because she was left-handed, and people who thought they were choosing at random were in many cases simply going in the direction of their dominant hands. In his years as a cop, Norman had come to believe that telepathy was perfectly possible, but it was hard work, impossible work if you were wearing the wrong hat. You had to find your way into the head of the person you were after like some kind of tiny burrowing animal, and you had to keep listening for something that wasn't a beat but a brainwave. Not a thought, precisely, but a way of thinking. And when you finally had that, you could take a shortcut. You could go racing across the curve of your quarry's thoughts, and some night, when he or she least expected it, there you'd be, stepping out from behind the door, or lying under the bed with a knife in your hand, ready to ram it upward through the mattress the moment the spring squeaked and the poor sapette in this case, lay down. When you least expect it, Norman murmured as he sat in what he hoped had been her seat. He liked the sound of it, and so he said it again as the bus backed out of its slot, ready to head west. When you least expect it. It was a long trip, but he rather enjoyed it. Twice he got off to use the toilet at rest stops when he didn't really need to go because he knew she would have needed to go, and she wouldn't have wanted to use the bus toilet. Rose was fastidious, but Rose also had weak kidneys, probably a little genetic gift from her late mother, who had always looked to Norman like the sort of bitch who couldn't trot past a lilac bush without a pause to squat and piddle. At the second of these rest stops, he saw half a dozen people clustered around a butt can at one corner of the building. He watched longingly for a moment, then went past them and inside. He was dying for a smoke, but Rose wouldn't have been. She didn't have the habit. Instead, he paused to handle a number of fuzzy stuffed animals because Rose liked crap like that, and then purchased a paperback mystery from the rack by the door because she sometimes read that shit. He had told her a billion times that real police work was nothing like the crap in those books, and she always agreed with him. If he said it, it must be true, but she went on reading them just the same. He wouldn't have been too surprised to learn that Rose had turned this same rack, had picked a book from it, and then put it reluctantly back again, not wanting to spend $5 on 3 hours' entertainment when she had so little money and so many unanswered questions. He ate a salad, forcing himself to read the book as he did, and then went back to his seat on the bus. In a little while, they were off again, Norman sitting still with his book in his lap, watching the fields open out more and more as the east gave up its hold. He turned his watch back when the driver announced it was time to do so, not because he gave a shit about time zones, he was on his own clock for the next 30 days or so, but because that was what Rose would have done. He picked the book up, read about a vicar finding a body in a garden, and put it down again, bored. Yet, that was only on the surface. Deeper down, he wasn't bored at all. Deeper down, he felt strangely like Goldilocks in the old kid's story. He was sitting in Baby Bear's chair. He had Baby Bear's book in his lap, and he was going to find Baby Bear's little housey. Before long, if all went well, he would be hiding underneath Baby Bear's little beddy. When you least expect it, he said. When you least expect it. He got off the bus in the early hours of the following morning and stood just inside the door from the loading gate, surveying the echoing high-ceiling terminal, trying to put aside his cop's assessment of the pimps and the whores, the butt boys and the beggars, trying to see it as she must have seen it, getting off this same bus and walking into this same terminal and seeing it at this same hour when human nature is always at low tide. He stood there and let this echoing world flood in on him, its look and smell and taste and feel. Who am I? He asked himself. Rose Daniels, he answered. How do I feel? Small, lost, and terrified, That's the bottom line right there. I'm utterly terrified. For a moment, he was overwhelmed by an awful idea. What if, in her fear and panic, Rose had approached the wrong person? It was certainly possible. For a certain type of bad guy, places like this were feeding pools. What if that wrong person had led her off into the dark, then robbed and murdered her? It was no good telling himself it was unlikely. He was a cop and knew it wasn't. If a crackhead saw that stupid gumball machine ring of hers, for instance. He took several deep breaths, regrouping, refocusing the part of his mind that was trying to be Rose. What else was there to do? If she'd been murdered, she'd been murdered. There was nothing he could do about it, so it was best not to think of it. And besides, he couldn't bear the thought that she might have escaped him that way, that some coked-up boogie might have taken what belonged to Norman Daniels. Never mind, he told himself. Never mind. Just do your job. And right now, your job is to walk like Rosie, talk like Rosie, think like Rosie. He moved slowly out into the terminal, holding his wallet in one hand. It was his substitute for her purse. Looking at the people who rushed past in riptide, some dragging suitcases, some balancing string-tied cardboard boxes on their shoulders, some with their arms around the shoulders of their girlfriends or the waists of their boyfriends. As he watched, a man sprinted toward a woman and a little boy who had just gotten off Norman's bus. The man kissed the woman, then seized the little boy and tossed him high into the air. The little boy shrieked with fear and delight. I'm scared. Everything's new. Everything's different, and I'm scared to death, Norman told himself. Is there anything I feel sure about? Anything I feel I can trust? Anything at all? He walked across the wide tile floor, but slowly, slowly, listening to his feet echo and trying to look at everything through Rose's eyes, trying to feel everything through her skin. A quick peek at the glassy-eyed kids, with some it was just 3 in the morning tiredness, with some it was Nebraska red, in the video alcove, then back into the terminal itself. She looks at the bank of payphones, but who is she going to call? She has no friends, she has no family, not even the providential old aunt in the Texas Panhandle or the mountains of Tennessee. She looks at the doors to the street, perhaps thinking of leaving, of finding a room for the night, a door to put between her and the whole wide, confusing, and different, dangerous world. She has money enough for a room, thanks to his ATM card, but does she do it? Norman stopped by the foot of the escalator, frowning, changing the shape of the question. Do I do it? No, he decided. I don't. I don't want to check into a motel at 3:30 and be kicked out at noon, for one thing. It's bad value for my money. I can stay up a little longer, run on my nerves a little longer if I have to. But there's something else keeping me here as well. I'm in a strange city, and dawn is still at least 2 hours away. I've seen a lot of TV crime shows. I've read a lot of paperback mysteries, and I'm married to a cop. I know what can happen to a woman who goes out into the darkness by herself, and I think I'll wait for sunrise. So what do I do? How do I pass the time? His stomach answered the question for him, rumbling. Yes, I have something to eat. The last rest stop was at 6 in the evening, and I'm pretty hungry. There was a cafeteria not far from the ticket windows, and Norman went that way, stepping over the bag bums and restraining the urge to kick a few ugly, lice-ridden heads into the nearest steel chair leg. This was an urge he had to restrain more and more often these days. He hated homeless people, thought of them as dog turds with legs. He hated their whining excuses and their inept pretenses at insanity. When one who was only semi-comatose stumbled over to him and asked if he had any spare change, Norman was barely able to resist an impulse to grab the bum's arm and heat him up with an old-fashioned Indian burn. Instead, he said, "Leave me alone, please," in a soft voice, because that's what she would have said and how she would have said it. He started to grab bacon and scrambled eggs from the steam table, then remembered she didn't eat that stuff unless he insisted, which he sometimes did. What she ate wasn't important to him, but her not forgetting who was boss of the shooting match was important, very important. He ordered cold cereal instead, along with a foul cup of coffee and half a grapefruit that looked as if it might have come over on the Mayflower. The food made him feel better, more awake. When he was done, he grabbed automatically for a cigarette, briefly touched the pack in his shirt pocket, then let his hand drop away. Rose didn't smoke. Therefore, Rose wouldn't be subject to the craving he now felt. After a moment or two of meditation on this subject, the craving retreated, as he had known it would. The first thing he saw as he came out of the cafeteria and stood there, tucking in the back of his shirt with the hand that wasn't holding his wallet, was a large, lighted blue and white circle with the words, Traveler's Aid, printed on the outer stripe. Inside Norman's head, a bright light suddenly went on. Do I go there? Do I go to the booth under that big, comforting sign? Do I see if there's anything there for me? Of course I do. Where else? He walked over there, but on a slant, first sliding past the booth and then hooking back toward it again, getting a good look at the booth's occupant from both sides. He was a pencil-necked Jew boy who looked about 50 and about as dangerous as Bambi's friend Thumper. He was reading a newspaper Norman recognized as Pravda, and every now and then he would raise his head from it and shoot a meaningless random glance out into the terminal. If Norman had still been doing Rose, Thumper would undoubtedly have spotted him, but Norman was doing Norman again, Detective Inspector Daniels on stakeout, and that meant he blended into the scene. Mostly, he kept moving back and forth in a gentle arc behind the booth. Keeping in motion was the important part. In places like this, you didn't run much risk of being noticed unless you stood still. Staying out of Thumper's view, but within earshot of Thumper's conversations. Around 4:15, a crying woman came up to the Traveler's Aid booth. She told Thumper that she had been on the Greyhound from New York City, and someone had stolen her wallet out of her purse while she was sleeping. There was a lot of blah-de-blah. The woman used several of Thumper's Kleenexes, and he ended up finding a hotel that would trust her for a couple of nights until her husband could send her some more money. If I was your husband, lady, I'd bring you the money myself, Norman thought, still describing his drifting little back-and-forth pendulum movement behind the booth. I'd also bring you a swift kick in the ass for doing such a dumbass thing in the first place. In the course of his telephone conversation with the hotel, Thumper gave his name as Peter Slowick. It was enough for Norman. As the Jew boy began talking with the woman again, giving her directions, Norman quit the vicinity of the booth and returned to the payphones, where there were actually two telephone books which hadn't yet been torched, torn to pieces, or carried away. He could get the information he needed later in the day by calling his own police department, but he preferred not to do it that way. Depending on how things went with the Pravda reading Jew boy, calling people could be dangerous, the kind of thing that might come back to haunt a person later. And it turned out not to be necessary. There were just three Slowicks and one Slowick in the city directory. Only one of them was a Peter. Daniels jotted down Thumperstein's address, left the station, and walked over to the cab stand. The guy in the lead cab was white, a brake, and Norman asked him if there was a hotel left in this city where a person could get a room for cash and not have to listen to the cockroach races once the lights were off. The driver thought it over, then nodded. The Whitestone. Good, cheap, cash accepted, no questions. Norman opened the back door of the cab and got in. Let's do it, he said.
Robbie Lefferts was there just as he'd promised when Rosie followed the gorgeous redhead with the long fashion model legs into Studio C of Tape Engine on Monday morning. And he was as nice to her as he had been on the street corner when he'd persuaded her to read aloud from one of the paperbacks he had just bought. Rhoda Simons, the 40-ish woman who was to be her director, was also nice to her, but director? Such a strange word to think of in connection with Rosie McClendon, who hadn't even tried out for her senior class play. Curtis Hamilton, the recording engineer, was also nice, although he was at first too busy with his controls to do more than give her hand a quick, abstracted shake. Rosie joined Robbie and Miss Simons for a cup of coffee before setting sail, which was how Robbie put it, and she was able to manage her cup normally without spilling a single drop. Yet when she stepped through the double doors and into the small, glass-sided recording booth, she was seized with an attack of such overwhelming panic that she almost dropped the sheaf of Xerox pages, which Rhoda called the sides. She felt much as she had when she had seen the red car coming up Westmoreland Street toward her and thought it was Norman's Sentra. She saw them staring at her from the other side of the glass. Even serious young Curtis Hamilton was looking at her now, and their faces looked distorted and wavery, as if she were seeing them through water instead of air.
This is the way goldfish see people who bend down to look in through the side of the tank, she thought. And on the heels of that, I can't do this. What in the name of God ever made me think I could? There was a loud click that made her jump. Ms. McClendon? It was the recording engineer's voice. Could you sit down in front of the mic so I can get a level? She wasn't sure she could. She wasn't sure she could even move. She was rooted to the spot, looking across the room to where the head of the mic was pointing at her like the head of some dangerous, futuristic snake. Even if she did manage to cross the room, nothing would come out of her mouth once she sat down, not so much as a single dry squeak. In that moment, Rosie saw the collapse of everything she had built up. It flashed past her mind's eye with the nightmarish speed of an old Keystone Cop short. She saw herself turned out of the pleasant little room she'd lived in for only 4 days when her small supply of cash ran out. Saw herself getting the cold shoulder from everyone at Daughters and Sisters, even Anna herself. I can't very well give you your old place back, can I? She heard Anna say inside her head. There are always new girls here at DNS, as you know very well, and they have to be my first priority. Why were you so foolish, Rosie? Whatever made you think you could be a performance artist, even at such a humble level as this? She saw herself being turned away from the waitress jobs in the downtown coffee shops, not because of how she looked, but because of how she smelled, of defeat, shame, and lost expectations. Rosie, that was Rob Lefferts, would you sit down so Kurt can get a level? He didn't know, neither of the men knew, but Rhoda Simons did, or suspected at least. She had taken the pencil which had been sticking out of her hair and was doodling on a pad in front of her. She wasn't looking at what she was doodling, though. She was looking at Rosie, and her eyebrows were drawn together in a frown. Suddenly, like a drowning woman flailing for any piece of floating detritus which might support her for a little while longer, Rosie found herself thinking of her picture. She had hung it exactly where Anna had suggested, beside the window in the living room area. There had even been a picture hook there, left over from a previous tenant. It was the perfect place, especially in the evening. You could look out the window for a while, at the sun going down over the forested greeny black of Bryant Park, then back at the picture, then out at the park again. The two things seemed perfect together, the window and the picture and the window. She didn't know why it was so, but it was. If she lost the room, though, the picture would have to come down. No, it's got to stay there, she thought. It's supposed to stay there. That got her moving, at least. She walked slowly across to the table, put her sides, they were photo enlargements of the pages of a paperback novel published in 1951, in front of her, and sat down. Except it felt more like falling down, as if her knees were locked in position by pins and someone had just pulled them. You can do this, Rosie, the deep voice assured her, but its authority now sounded false. You did it on the street corner outside the pawn shop, and you can do it here. She wasn't terribly surprised to find herself unconvinced. What did surprise her was the thought which followed. The woman in the picture wouldn't be afraid of this. The woman in the rose madder chiton wouldn't be afraid of this piddle at all. And the idea was ridiculous, of course. If the woman in the picture were real, she would have existed in an ancient world where comets were considered harbingers of doom, gods were thought to dally on the tops of mountains, and most folks lived and died without ever seeing a book. If a woman from that time were transported into a room like this, a room with glass walls and cold lights, and a steel snake's head poking out of the only table, she would either run screaming for the door or faint dead away. Except Rosie had an idea that the blonde woman in the rose madder chiton had never fainted dead away in her entire life, and it would take a lot more than a recording studio to make her scream. You're thinking about her as if she's real, the deep voice said. It sounded nervous. Are you sure that's wise? If it gets me through this, you bet, she thought back at it. Rosie? It was Rhoda Simon's voice coming through the speakers. Are you all right? Yes, she said, and was relieved to find that her voice was still there, only a little croaky. I'm thirsty, that's all. I'm scared to death.
There's a cooler filled with Evian water and fruit juices under the left side of the table, Rhoda said. As for being afraid, that's natural, and it will pass. Give me a little more, Rosie, Curtis invited. He had a pair of earphones on now and was tweaking a row of dials. The panic was passing, thanks to the woman in the Rose Madder gown. As a comative, thinking of her even beat 15 minutes of rocking in Pooh's chair. No, it's not her, it's you, the deep voice told her. You're on top of it, kiddo, at least for the time being, but you did it yourself. And would you do me a favor, no matter how the rest of this turns out, try to keep remembering who's really Rosie around here, and who's Rosie real?
Talk about anything, Curtis was telling her. Doesn't matter what.
For a moment, she was utterly at a loss. Her eyes dropped to the sides in front of her. The first was a cover reproduction. It showed a scantily clad woman being menaced by a hulking, unshaven man with a knife. The man had a mustache, and a thought almost too fleeting to be recognizable. "Want to get it on? Want to do the dog?" brushed past her consciousness like a breath of bad air.
"I'm going to read a book called The Manta Ray," she said in what she hoped was a normal speaking voice. "It was published in 1951 by Lion Books, a little paperback company, although it says on the cover that the author's name is... Have you got enough?"
"I'm fine on the reel-to-reel," Curtis said, foot-powering himself from one end of his board to the other in his wheeled chair. "Just give me a little more for the dat, but you're sounding good."
"Yes, wonderful," Rhoda said, and Rosie didn't think she was imagining the relief in the director's voice.
Feeling encouraged, Rosie addressed the mic again.
"It says on the cover that the book was written by Richard Racine, but Mr. Lefferts, Rob, says it was actually written by a woman called Christina Bell. It's part of an unabridged audio series called Women in Disguise, and I got this job because the woman who was supposed to read the Christina Bell novels got a part in it."
"I'm fine," Curtis Hamilton said.
"My God, she sounds like Liz Taylor in Butterfield 8, Rhoda Simon said, and actually clapped her hands. Robbie nodded. He was grinning, obviously delighted.
"Rhoda will help you along, but if you do it just like you did Dark Passage for me outside the Liberty City, we're all going to be very happy." Rosie leaned over, just avoided whamming her head on the side of the table, and got a bottle of Evian water from the cooler. When she twisted the cap, she saw that her hands were shaking.
"I'll do my best, I promise you that."
"I know you will," he said.
"Think of the woman on the hill," Rosie told herself. "Think of how she's standing there right now, not afraid of anything coming toward her in her world, or coming up behind her from mine. She doesn't have a single weapon, but she's not afraid. You don't need to see her face to know that. You can see it in the set of her back. She's
ready for anything," Rosie murmured and smiled. Robbie leaned forward on his side of the glass. "Pardon? I didn't get that."
"I've said I'm ready to go," she said.
"Level's good," Curtis said and turned to Rhoda, who had set out her own Xeroxed copy of the novel next to her pad of paper. "Ready when you are, Professor."
"Okay, Rosie, let's show 'em how it's done," Rhoda said.
"This is The Manta Ray by Christina Bell. The client is Audio Concepts, the director is Rhoda Simons, and the reader is Rose McClendon. Tape is rolling. Take one on my mark, and mark."
"Oh, God, I can't," Rosie thought once more, and then she narrowed her mind's vision down to a single, powerfully bright image— the gold circlet the woman in the picture wore on her upper right arm. As it came clear to her, this fresh cramp of panic also began to pass. Chapter 1. Nella didn't realize she was being followed by the man in the ragged gray topcoat until she was between streetlights, and a garbage-strewn alley yawned open on her left, like the jaws of an old man who has died with food in his mouth. By then, it was too late. She heard the sound of shoes with steel taps on her heels closing in behind her, and a big, dirt-grimed hand shot out of the dark.
Rosie pushed her key into the lock of her second-floor room on Trenton Street that evening at 7:15. She was tired and hot,
Summer had come early to the city this year, but she was also very happy. Curled in one arm was a little bag of groceries. Poking out of the top was a sheaf of yellow flyers announcing the Daughters and Sisters Swing Into Summer picnic and concert. Rosie had gone by DNS to tell them how her first day at work had gone. She was all but bursting with it. And as she was leaving, Robin St. James had asked her if she would take a handful of flyers and try to place them with the storekeepers in her neighborhood. Rosie, trying hard not to show how thrilled she was just to have a neighborhood, agreed to get as many up as she could. "You're a lifesaver," Robin said. She was in charge of ticket sales this year and had made no secret of the fact that so far they weren't going very well. "And if anybody asks you, Rosie, tell them there are no teenage runaways here and that we're not dykes. These stories are half the problem with sales. Will you do that?" "Sure," Rosie had replied, knowing she'd do no such thing. She couldn't imagine giving a storekeeper she had never met before a lecture on what Daughters and Sisters was all about and what it wasn't all about. "But I can say they're nice women," she thought, turning on the fan in the corner and then opening the fridge to put away her few things. Then, out loud, "No, I'll say ladies, nice ladies." Sure, that was probably a better idea. Men, especially those past 40, for some reason felt more comfortable with that word than they did with women. It was silly, and the way some women fussed and clucked over the semantics was even sillier, in Rose's opinion. But thinking about it called up a sudden memory. How Norman talked about the prostitutes he sometimes busted. He never called them ladies. That was the word he used when talking about the wives of his colleagues, as in, "Bill Jessup's wife's a real nice lady." He never called them women, either. He called them the gals. The gals this and the gals that. She had never realized until this moment how much she hated that hard little back-of-the-throat word, gals. Like a sound you might make when you were trying hard not to vomit. "Forget him, Rosie. He's not here. He's not going to be here." As always, this simple thought filled her with joy, amazement, and gratitude. She had been told, mostly in the therapy circle at DNS, that these euphoric feelings would pass, but she found that hard to believe. She was on her own. She had escaped the monster. She was free. Rosie closed the refrigerator door, turned around, and looked across her room. The furnishings were minimal, and the decorations, except for her picture, were non-existent. But she still saw nothing which did not make her want to crow with delight. There were pretty cream-colored walls that Norman Daniels had never seen. There was a chair from which Norman Daniels had never pushed her for being smart. There was a TV Norman Daniels had never watched, sneering at the news or laughing along with the reruns of All in the Family and Cheers. Best of all, there was not a single corner where she'd sat crying and reminding herself to vomit into her apron if she got sick to her stomach. Because he wasn't here. He wasn't going to be here. "I'm on my own," Rosie murmured, and then actually hugged herself with joy. She walked across the room to the picture. The blonde woman, Chiton, seemed almost to glow in the late spring light, and she was a woman. Rosie thought, not a lady, and most certainly not a gal. She stood up there on her hill, looking fearlessly down at the ruined temple and the tumbled gods. Gods? But there's only one, isn't there? No. She saw there were actually two. The one peering serenely up at the thunderheads from its place near the fallen pillar, and another one way over to the right. This one was gazing sideways through the tall grass. You could just see the white curve of stone brow, the orbit of one eye, and the lobe of an ear. The rest was hidden. She hadn't noticed this one until now, but what of that? There were probably lots of things in the picture she hadn't noticed yet, lots of little details. It was like one of those Where's Waldo pictures, full of things you didn't see at first, and that was bullshit. The picture was very simple, actually. "Well," Rosie whispered, "it was." She found herself thinking of Cynthia's story about the picture in the parsonage where she had grown up, De Soto Looks West, how she'd sat in front of it for hours, watching it like television, watching the river move. Pretending to watch it move, Rosie said, and ran up the window hoping to catch a breeze and fill the room with it. The thin voices of little kids in the park playground and bigger kids playing baseball drifted in. Pretending, that's all. That's what kids do. I did it myself. She put a stick in the window to prop it open. It would stay where it was for a little bit, then come down with a crash if you didn't, and turned to look at the picture again. A sudden, dismaying thought, an idea so strong it was almost a certainty, had come to her. The folds and creases in the rose madder gown were not the same. They had changed position. They had changed position because the woman wearing the toga or chiton or whatever it was had changed position. "You're crazy if you think that," Rosie whispered. Her heart was thumping. "I mean, totally bonkers. You know that, don't you?" She did. Nevertheless, she leaned close to the picture, peering into it. She stayed in that position with her eyes less than 2 inches from the painted woman on top of the hill for almost 30 seconds, holding her breath so as not to fog the glass which overlaid the image. At last she pulled back and let the air out of her lungs in a sigh that was mostly relief. The creases and folds in the chiton hadn't changed a bit. She was sure of it. Well, almost sure. It was just her imagination playing tricks on her after her long day, a day which had been both wonderful and terribly stressful. "Yeah, but I got through it," she told the woman in the chiton. Talking out loud to the woman in the painting already seemed perfectly okay to her. A little eccentric, maybe, but so what? Who did it hurt? Who even knew? And the fact that the blonde's back was turned somehow made it easier to believe she was really listening. Rosie went to the window, propped the heels of her hands on the sill, and looked out. Across the street, laughing children ran the bases and pumped on the swings. Directly below her, a car was pulling in at the curb. There had been a time when the sight of a car pulling in like that would have terrified her, filled her with visions of Norman's fist and Norman's ring riding on it, riding toward her, the words service, loyalty, and community getting bigger and bigger until they seemed to fill the whole world. But that time had passed. Thank God. "Actually, I think I did a little more than just get through it," she told the picture. "I think I did a really good job. Robbie thought so, I know, but the one I really had to convince was Rhoda. I think she was prepared not to like me when I came in, because I was Robbie's find, you know?" She turned toward the picture once more, turned as a woman will turn to a friend, wanting to judge from her face how some idea or statement strikes her. But of course the woman in the picture just went on looking down the hill toward the ruined temple, giving Rosie nothing but her back to judge from. "You know how bitchy us gals can be," Rosie said and laughed. "Except I really think I won her over. We only got through 50 pages, but I was a lot better toward the end. Besides, all those old paperbacks are short. I'll bet I can finish by Wednesday afternoon. And do you know the best thing? I'm making almost $120 a day. And not a week, a day. And there are 3 more Christina Bell novels. If Robbie and Rhoda give me those, I..." She broke off, staring at the picture with wide eyes, not hearing the thin cries from the playground anymore, not even hearing the footsteps which were now climbing the stairs from the first floor. She was looking at the shape on the far right side of the picture again. Curve of brow, curve of bland, pupilless eye, curve of ear. A sudden insight came to her. She had been both right and wrong. Right about that second crash statue's not being visible before, wrong in her impression that the stone head had somehow just materialized in the picture while she'd been off recording the manta ray. Her idea that the folds in the woman's dress had changed position might have been her subconscious mind's effort to bolster that first erroneous impression by creating a kind of hallucination. It did, after all, make slightly more sense than what she was seeing now.
The picture is bigger,
Rosie said. No, that wasn't quite it. She lifted her hands, sizing the air in front of the hung picture and confirming the fact that it was still covering the same 3 feet by 2 feet area of wall. She was also seeing the same amount of white matting inside the frame, so what was the big deal?
That second stone head wasn't there before, and that's the big deal, she thought.
Maybe... Rosie suddenly felt dizzy and a little sick to her stomach. She closed her eyes tightly and began rubbing at her temples where a headache was trying to be born. When she opened her eyes and looked at the picture again, it burst upon her as it had the first time, not as separate elements. The temple, the fallen statues, the rose madder chiton, the raised left hand, but as an integrated whole, something which called to her in its own voice.
There was more to look at now. She was nearly positive that this impression wasn't hallucination, but simple fact. The picture wasn't really bigger, but she could see more on both sides, and on the top and bottom as well. It was as if a movie projectionist had just realized he was using the wrong lens and switched, turning boxy 35mm into widescreen Cinerama 70. Now you could see not just Clint, but the cowboys on both sides of him as well.
You're nuts, Rosie. Pictures don't get bigger.
No?
Then how do you explain the second god? She was sure it had been there all the time, and she was only seeing it now because there's more right in the picture now, she murmured. Her eyes were very wide, although it would have been difficult to say if the expression in them was dismay or wonder. Also more left, and more up, and more...
There was a sudden flurry of knocks on the door behind her, so fast and light, they almost seemed to collide with each other. Rosie whirled around, feeling as if she were moving in slow motion or underwater. She hadn't locked the door. The knocks came again. She remembered the car she'd seen pulling up at the curb below, a small car, the kind of car a man traveling alone would be apt to rent from Hertz or Avis. And all thoughts of her picture were overwhelmed by another thought, one edged about in dark tones of resignation and despair. Norman had found her, after all. It had taken him a while, but somehow he had done it. Part of her last conversation with Anna recurred, Anna asking what she'd do if Norman did show up. Lock the door and dial 911, she'd said, but she had forgotten to lock the door, and there was no phone. That last was the most hideous irony of all, because there was a jack in the corner of the living room area, and the jack was live. She'd gone to the phone company on her lunch hour today and paid a deposit. The woman who waited on her had given her her new telephone number on a little white card. Rosie had tucked it into her purse, and then out the door she'd marched, right past the display of phones for sale she had marched, thinking she could get one at least $10 cheaper by marching out to the Lakeview Mall when she got a chance. And now, just because she'd wanted to save a lousy $10... Silence from the other side of the door. But when she dropped her eyes to the crack at the bottom... She could see the shapes of his shoes. Big, black, shiny shoes they would be. He no longer wore the uniform, but he still wore those black shoes. They were hard shoes. She could testify to that, because she had worn their marks on her legs and belly and buttocks many times over her years with him. The knocking was repeated. 3 quick series of 3 rap-rap-rap pause. Rap-rap-rap. Pause. Rap, rap, rap. Once again, as during her terrible breathless panic that morning in the recording booth, Rosie's mind turned to the woman in the picture, standing there on top of the overgrown hill, not afraid of the coming thunderstorm, not afraid that the ruins slumped below her might be haunted by ghosts or trolls, or just some wandering band of thugs, not afraid of anything. You could tell by the set of her back, by the way her hand was so nonchalantly raised. Even so Rosie really believed, by the shape of that one barely glimpsed breast. I'm not her. I am afraid.
so afraid I'm almost wetting my pants. But I'm not going to let you just take me, Norman. I swear to God I won't do that.
For a moment or two, she tried to remember the throw Gert Kinshaw had shown her, the one where you seized the forearms of your onrushing opponent and then turned sideways. It was no good. When she tried to visualize the crucial move, all she could see was Norman coming at her, his lips drawn back to show his teeth, drawn back in what she thought of as his biting smile, wanting to talk to her, up close, right up close. Her grocery bag was still standing on the kitchen counter with the yellow picnic announcement flyers beside it. She'd taken out the perishables and stuck them in the refrigerator, but the few canned goods she'd picked up were still in the bag. She walked across to the counter on legs which seemed as devoid of feeling as wooden planks and reached in. Three more quick knocks. Rap, rap, rap.
Coming, Rosie said.
Her voice sounded amazingly calm to her own ears. She pulled out the biggest thing left in the bag, a 2-pound can of fruit cocktail. She closed her hand around it as best she could and started toward the door on her numb wood plank legs.
I'm coming. Just a second, be right there.
While Rosie was marketing, Norman Daniels was lying on a Whitestone hotel bed in his underwear, smoking a cigarette and staring up at the ceiling. He had picked up the smoking habit as many boys do, hooking cigarettes from his dad's packs of Pall Malls, resigning himself to a beating if he got caught, thinking that possibility a fair trade for the status you gain by being seen downtown on the corner of State and Route 49, leaning against a phone pole outside the Aubreyville drugstore and post office, perfectly at home, with the collar of your jacket turned up and that cigarette dripping down from your lower lip. Crazy, baby, I'm just a real cool breeze. When your friends passed in their old cars, how could they know you'd hawked the butt from the pack on your old man's dresser, or that the one time you'd gotten up courage enough to try and buy a pack of your own in the drug, old man Gregory had snorted and told you to come back when you could grow a mustache. Smoking had been a big deal at 15, a very big deal, something that had made up for all the stuff he hadn't been able to have. A car, for instance, even an old jalop like the ones his friends drove, cars with primer on the rocker panels and white plastic steel around the headlights and bumpers held on with twists of haywire. And by the time he was 16, he was hooked, 2 packs a day and a bona fide smoker's hack in the morning. 3 years after he married Rose, her entire family, father, mother, 16-year-old brother, had been killed on that same Route 49. They had been coming back from an afternoon of swimming at Philo's Quarry when a gravel truck veered across the road and wiped them out like flies on a window pane. Old man McClendon's severed head had been found in a ditch 30 yards from the crash, with the mouth open and a generous splash of crow shit in one eye. By then, Daniels was a cop, and cops heard such things. These facts hadn't disturbed Daniels in the least. He had, in fact, been delighted by the accident. As far as he was concerned, the nosy old bastard had gotten exactly what he had coming to him. McClendon had been prone to asking his daughter questions he had no business asking. Rose wasn't McClendon's daughter anymore, after all, not in the eyes of the law, at least. In the eyes of the law, she had become Norman Daniels' wife. He dragged deep on his cigarette, blew 3 smoke rings, and watched them float slowly toward the ceiling in a stack. Outside, traffic beeped and honked. He had only been here half a day, and already he hated this city. It was too big. It had too many hiding places. Not that it mattered, because things were right on track, and soon a very hard and very heavy brick wall was going to drop onto Craig McClendon's wayward little daughter, Rosie. At the McClendon funeral, a triple-header with just about everyone in Aubreyville in attendance, Daniels had started coughing and had been unable to stop. People were turning around to look at him, and he hated that kind of staring worse than practically anything. Red-faced, furious with embarrassment, but still unable to stop coughing, Daniels pushed past his sobbing young wife and hurried out of the church with one hand pressed uselessly over his mouth. He stood outside, coughing so hard at first, he had to bend over and put his hands on his knees to keep from actually passing out. Looking through his watery eyes at several others who had stepped out for cigarettes, 3 men and 2 women who weren't able to go cold turkey even for a lousy half-hour funeral service. And suddenly, he decided he was done smoking. Just like that. He He knew that the coughing fit might have been brought on by his usual summer allergies, but that didn't matter. It was a dumb fucking habit, maybe the dumbest fucking habit on the planet, and he was damned if some county coroner was going to write Paul Malls on the cause of death line of his death certificate. On the day he had come home and found Rosie gone, that night actually, after he discovered the ATM card was missing and could